Our next case is United States v. Ellis. Because this is a TJAG certified case, the government will argue first. So, Captain Schaefer, are you prepared to argue on behalf of the government?
Yes, sir.
And Captain Creighton, are you prepared to argue on behalf of Appellee?
Yes, sir.
Thank you. Please proceed.
Chief Judge Olson, members of the court, may it please the court. I'm Captain Nicholas Schaefer, and along with my co-counsel, Colonel Richard Guarini, we represent the United States. The government respectfully requests to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal, Your Honor.
Granted.
Without providing sufficient legal support or explanation, the Army Court conjured a new instructional requirement for an Article 133 charge implicating private speech. The military judge, however, did not err with the instructions given, and the defense affirmatively waived any additional instruction on the First Amendment. Therefore, this court should reverse the Army Court's decision. Now, turning first to the issue of the mandatory instruction.
Counsel, before we get there, since your last sentence was about waiver, the government did not raise this issue at the CCA. So did the government relinquish its argument with regards to waiver?
No, Your Honor. The Army Court addressed it sua sponte. It's true that this was not raised in the briefs before the Army Court, but the Army Court addressed it, and they did so in error, and so it merits consideration for this certified question. Okay. It is a de novo issue, and the cases that are cited by Appellee are, first of all, persuasive in the federal circuit courts and not binding on this court. And also the Supreme Court case that is cited specifically says that it is within the court's power to address an issue that would otherwise be waived, that it sometimes is a sound prudential judgment. And the Army Court made that judgment. And it is appropriate for this court to look if there is an error to be considered at all or if it is extinguished.
Okay. Thank you.
Now, since we're talking about waiver, just addressing waiver first. The Army Court has erred by transmogrifying motions to dismiss into something completely separate, into a preserved objection or request for an instruction. It's true that a failure to request an instruction is not enough to constitute waiver, but what we have here is controlled and similar to U.S. v. Davis. This is an affirmative acquiescence, a knowing and voluntary relinquishment of a known right. In this case, starting on Joint Appendix 79, there are multiple 802 sessions. There are multiple Article 39A proceedings where the parties both clearly consider the instructions separately and also discuss them together. And both parties, but particular defense, actively participated in the instructions process, making requests for additional instructions, making objections to specific instructions, and then even correcting the military judge on the record while he was reading the instructions verbally to the panel members. And so this shows this active participation, this knowledge of what the substance of the law being instructed was.
So, was someone about to ask? Counsel, what are we to make of, the CCA raises the issue that, the transmogrified, but that the two things, the fact that the military judge caveated his language prior to going into the instructions, so noting all outstanding objections, and the fact that he had not ruled on the 917 motion, so that was still pending. The CCA's rationale was that in light of those two facts, the military judge himself kind of converted what had been this motion into an objection to the instructions. So what's the government's position with regards to that?
Yes, Your Honor. So that language of objections and such was clearly within the circumstances, within the context of the panel instruction discussion. And so it was after he had thanked the parties for correcting him on the record, saying, after correcting myself, changing those Scrivener's errors that had been made, and subject to objections and such, again, within the context of the instructions, have I given the all of the correct substantive law in this case? Now that's, or words to that effect. And so the "and such" does not somehow magically make a motion to dismiss into something that is not. U.S. v. Rich talks about the necessity for specificity in objections. For something to be preserved, there has to be specificity, and U.S. v. Rich even talks about the fact that typically that includes a request for an additional instruction is actually giving what the language would be. And so simply having this language from the judge does not somehow create something out of nothing. And it's important to note, the Oxford Dictionary definition of transmogrify is to transform something in a surprising or magical manner. It has been used in military case law before, but it has always been used in the context of this court will not or cannot transmogrify something into another thing. And so the Army Court inadvertently used an apt phrase for what they did. They attempted legal alchemy to make something into something that it is not.
Counsel, I think this is the case, but I wanted you to confirm for me. Your waiver argument is specifically to any objections to the instructions, right? You would agree that appellant preserved the argument that he was being convicted for constitutionally protected speech?
Yes, Your Honor.
And if the CCA thought that was the case or we thought that was the case, that is still a live issue in the case.
That is correct, Your Honor.
So the waiver argument is very specifically limited to objections to the panel instructions.
Correct, Your Honor. It is strictly on the instructions piece. When the defense gave that affirmative acquiescence, similar to what is discussed in U.S. v. Gutierrez, in citing to Mundy and Smith, that language of, as best we can tell, yes, sir, you have given the substantive instructions correctly. And so, notwithstanding the motion to dismiss itself, the instructions, there was affirmative waiver.
So why didn't the military judge say, wait a minute, it's conditional, as best we can tell. Are you satisfied with the instructions or not? Why didn't that take place? Why should we look at that type of mealy-mouthed response as being not waiver?
Because, Your Honor, that is every time someone answers, you know, subject to objections, is this the substantive law? They are always giving their answer to the best of their ability, as best they can tell. And so while that language is not the most precise, again, citing to Gutierrez and specifically going to Smith, the language was, that's not exactly what I wanted, but it's close. In Mundy, the language was, defense would leave it up to the law officer without submitting any specific recommendations or committing itself one way or the other. This language is much more affirmative. This language is much more definite than the language that was cited for waiver, examples of waiver in Gutierrez.
And so while the military judge said, are the parties satisfied that I did correctly, subject to all the objections and such, why isn't that the legal equivalent of yada, yada, yada?
While it's not the most precise language, Your Honor, it is talking about within the panel instruction context. There were objections. There were requests for additional instructions. There were corrections made within that panel instruction while the panel instructions were being given and while they were being discussed at length on the record and in 802 sessions. And so
I want to make sure you have enough time to fully address the substantive issue here. Not that I'm in any way denigrating these other issues, but could you please turn your attention to the First Amendment issues?
Yes, Your Honor. And so for the matter of the instruction itself, the mandatory instruction, it's important first to note that the protections of the First Amendment apply differently. This is something that has been consistent from the Supreme Court precedent of Parker v. Levy and as well as this Court's precedent. Because we operate in the military in a specialized society, and there are different requirements for mission accomplishment. And
so I assume you've had an opportunity to review and reflect upon the amicus brief that was submitted by Air Force Defense Appellate Division?
Yes, Your Honor.
Why isn't Major Ward correct? He's essentially saying in there that the clear and present danger standard is a relic of the past, and that this court has essentially recognized that in Grijalva, Smith, and we've moved on, and that the correct standard now is a direct and palpable connection to the military mission.
Your Honor, in looking at Wilcox and Smith, these cases were looking at Article 134, Article 116. It was separate from an Article 133.
But why is that a distinction? And I would note in Grijalva, the language that was used by this court was talking about the First Amendment. It wasn't tying it directly to issue of 134.
Yes, Your Honor. So while it is important to note that this case is specifically the certified issue is about the mandatory instruction. And so there is a live question that was previously mooted but is still pending Army Court review if it is sent back for the First Amendment. But that is not the question before the court today. The mandatory instruction, the nature of the mandatory instruction is what is at issue. And it is important to note that the military judge is the one who answers questions of law. He gives instructions sufficient to provide necessary guideposts for an informed deliberation on guilt or innocence.
So I'm trying to grasp what you're trying to slice here. You're saying that this issue is not before the court about what the appropriate standard is?
Correct, Your Honor, because the Army Court, while they
But you in your brief went on, I would lose track if I attempted to count the number of times you said clear and present danger is the correct standard. You're now saying all of that in your brief was irrelevant to the issue before this court.
It was setting out the context, Your Honor, and the clear and present danger test is the correct standard. It is set out by U.S. v. Hartwig, the court's first look at is this constitutionally protected on the civilian side. But there are different constitutional protections, and even
so,
if it
wait a minute. Let's keep our focus on this issue of you're saying it is not before this court what the proper standard is, and I'd like you to expound upon your explanation for why that is.
What the correct standard is, Your Honor?
You just indicated that that issue is not before us with the issues that were certified by the Judge Advocate General.
Yes, Your Honor. It is only before this court in the narrow context of what was the mandatory instruction. And so the mandatory instruction to be given to the panel is not a question of law. The question of law of constitutional protection is a question answered by the military judge. And whether he got that question correct or not is not the question before the court.
But, counsel, I'm sorry, Chief.
No, please.
I think what the chief is trying to get at is that doesn't the predicate issue of whether this is protected speech have to be decided in order for us to get to whether a mandatory instruction should or should not have been given? So I think that's what the chief is trying to drive at, that how can we even answer the certified questions if the government doesn't have a position with regards to the substantive issue of the quality or whether the speech was protected?
Your Honor, the question is simply, was an instruction on a question of law required? And so regardless of what that appropriate standard would have been, the question of law is something answered by the military judge. So because the military judge answered the question and then put the elements of Article 133 correctly before the panel, there was no necessity to instruct further on a question of law. It would not have been appropriate to ask the panel, does the First Amendment apply here? That is a question within the judge's purview.
So from your perspective, the government's perspective then, if this court were to decide that when it comes to First Amendment issues, that in fact this is something that the panel members had to be instructed on. I'm not asking you to concede that point. I'm just saying, if that were the case, we should not go further in our analysis. We should simply say, should have been instructed, because First Amendment issues were at play here. We are not going to opine about whether it should be clear and present danger or direct and palpable connection to the military mission and send it back down.
If the court gets to that step and says a question of law is something that should have been instructed on, then it needs to be sent back to decide what was the proper instruction. Because the Army Court has provided nothing, Appellee has provided nothing, defense provided nothing of what this instruction should look like. And so they have created this requirement. I'm sorry, Your Honor.
No, go ahead. I don't want to.
They've created this instructional requirement without actually telling what the instruction should be. Now, the government's position is that U.S. v. Hartwig still controls. It is still that the clear and present danger test, it is applied differently than it is in Schenck. Brandenburg came before Hartwig, and so the clear and present danger test is simply saying, incorporating this language from Article 133, the definitions found in the model instruction, which was given, that there's a clear and present danger that this private speech would seriously compromise an officer's standing by personally dishonoring or disgracing him or her.
Counsel, in the government's view, what is the purpose of the instruction about that begins conduct unbecoming of an officer means, and then there's the long paragraph? And what I'm getting at is the purpose of that instruction at least partially to exclude conduct that would be constitutionally protected, or is this just the president telling the field, this is what qualifies as it's not a constitutional issue at all. It's just that, in my view, this is what qualifies as conduct unbecoming an officer. And if it doesn't meet this standard, then it doesn't, regardless of any constitutional consideration.
Your Honor, it is. It's instructing on the definitions and elements. And so it is what qualifies here. The clear and present danger test would be a legal question decided by the judge beforehand to see if there is fair notice to a reasonable officer. And so it is separate. But the language of the clear and present danger test is simply saying there's this substantive evil that Congress has the right to prohibit, violations of the UCMJ. And after answering this question, then it is put to the panel members whether the offense has been met. I see my time has expired, if I may briefly.
I have a question.
Yes, Your Honor.
So within Grijalva, we said, quote, we interpret Wilcox to require the government to prove a direct and palpable connection to the military mission. So the panel members didn't need to be informed that that's what they had to convict on? If we're saying that the government needed to prove a direct and palpable connection, the panel members shouldn't be aware of what needed to be proved?
Your Honor, the direct and palpable connection to the military mission within the Article 133 realm is the seriously compromising a person's standing as an officer. And that is what Hartwig stands for, and that is the gravamen of the offense. That is what needs to be protected against and what allows otherwise protected speech to be prohibited.
But I don't hear an answer to my question in what you just said.
For the instructions specifically?
Yes. Why shouldn't the panel members need to know what the government needed to prove in order for there to be a righteous conviction?
Your Honor, the question of constitutional protection being a legal question is within the judge's realm. Often this is in U.S. v. Meekin, I believe in U.S. v. Wilcox, this is dealt with in a legal sufficiency standpoint. And so the direct and palpable connection is a question that the military judge is answering. The elements themselves, that is what the panel members are considering. And in the plurality opinion for U.S. v. Forney, it was specifically stated that there is no requirement to say that on the civilian side this is protected. They disclaimed the fact that this was not a quasi-affirmative defense, the First Amendment, for panel instructions. And so consistent with Forney, consistent with Meekin, and certainly consistent with this Court's predecessor in U.S. v. Hartwig, the military judge gave the elements of the offense. Once finding that the clear and present danger test was satisfied, saying you can consider this, it doesn't have to be instructed further that I have decided that there's not, this is constitutionally unprotected, because the protections are different.
Further questions from the bench? Captain Craig.
Good morning, Chief Judge Olson, members of the Court, and may it please the Court. This Court should affirm the Army Court's decision to set aside the findings for two reasons. One, the government cannot overcome the abuse of discretion standard afforded to the Army Court. And two, the military judge omitted key panel instructions, an issue Colonel Ellis did not waive. Turning first to the government's inability to demonstrate how the Army Court abused its discretion. The Army Court made findings of fact that were supported by the record and made correct conclusions of law. The government misinterpreted what the Army Court's decision actually stated when it certified the instant questions to this Court. And while this Court can pierce the Army Court's decision, without evidence to the contrary, the Army Court's findings of fact and conclusions of law should not be disturbed. Second, private protected speech was at issue from the inception of this court-martial. Twice, the defense moved to dismiss the specification on First Amendment grounds. Twice, the military judge denied those motions. And I would draw this Court's attention to JA 72, where the judge referred to these 917 motions as objections. Fast forwarding then, when the judge says, and subject to all prior objections and such, and the defense responded, as best we could tell, Your Honor, it's clear the party's understanding that the prior 917 motions and the motion to dismiss pre-trial were those standing objections. While this specification...
So, counsel, it's your position that, that in fact, because the military judge had previously referred to it as objections, that he did not transmogrify anything, that as the chief said, his reference subject to prior objections and such was a reference back to those motions, both the pending 917 at the time that he made that statement.
Your Honor, the issues were preserved. It was not a transmogrification. However, this trial took place in 2024, and that is post the change in the rules for court-martial 920 Fox, and that favors forfeiture if counsel fail to object to an instruction. And in this case, my counsel is correct. There was numerous discussion about many of the specifications, but there was a single line between the judge and the parties about Article 133. It was a single line that the judge said was, and the Court's standard instructions on Article 133, and then the parties continued on. And so that's a failure to object at that point, and that, under the new rules, would be forfeiture. While this specification should have never been placed in front of a fact finder, it was, and because of that, the military judge was required to provide the operative legal standard. And this is what the Army Court said. I would draw the Court's attention to JA page 9, in which the Army Court lays out, the panel members must obtain all operative legal guidance from the judge. They go on to say, without the proper explanation as to the clear and present danger legal standard applicable to the case involving an officer's private speech, appellant's panel was unable to consider this critical factor in reaching its guilty finding. The government is incorrect that the Army Court is asking for a new rule, or that it needed to lay out a new rule, or even that it was seeking a rule on the First Amendment. Rather, the Army Court was relying on Hartwig, which laid out the clear and present danger test. And because of this, Your Honors, this Court should affirm the setting aside of the specification and return this case to the Army Court. However, because this case also implicates First Amendment issues, and Your Honor was asking, I believe, about this Court's ability to go further than just the instructional issue, but the actual operative issue under the First Amendment protections, appellee's answer is yes, this Court certainly has that ability to go outside the certified questions in this case. This Court's Article 67 ability allows it to get to the ultimate question here, that appellee's speech was, from the inception, private, and it was protected. It contained no threats. It contained no incitements to violence or any other of the unprotected categories of speech that the Supreme Court has laid out. As well, the military judge, though heavily reliant on it in his ruling and his discussions with trial counsel, failed to instruct the panel on the requisite mens rea in this given case. The judge relied heavily on the government's assertion that this was the intent to humiliate, harass, or degrade, which is a specific intent, and he failed to do so. Again, yet another error, and again, why this Court should set aside the findings.
Counsel, why wasn't the instruction about that was given here, why wasn't it sufficient? Now, let me be more specific. So the clear and present danger test says that there's a clear and present danger that the speech will, in dishonoring or disgracing the officer personally, seriously compromise the person's standing. And then the instruction that was given said that the conduct in dishonoring or disgracing the person as an officer seriously compromises the officer's character. So one says there's a danger that it will happen, and then the instruction that was given to the panel said it did happen. It seems like if I was an accused, I'd rather the panel be told you have to believe that it did happen rather than just that there was a danger that it would happen. So maybe I'm reading this wrong, and if so, please, you can explain it to me. But why wasn't the instruction that was given even at least as protective as the clear and present danger standard?
Your Honor, on JA-104 is where the military judge instructed the panel, and he said, quote, whether his speech is likely to compromise his standing. And that likeliness is a very low standard. And so appellee's position is that the instruction that should have been provided references the clear and present danger standard, which is a heightened standard because there is the indication that the speech is private and normally would be protected under the auspices of the First Amendment if we were in the civilian world. So it's that the judge misread this and he said likely to compromise rather than the heightened clear and present danger standard.
Yeah. So if it had been the exact blue book instruction, that would have been sufficient?
No, Your Honor. And pardon me. I understand that there's only a few words that are disparate in that occasion, but the clear and present danger standard from Hartwig is a heightened standard. And without that, the quote-unquote, the standard instruction that he talked about in the colloquy it is not enough in this particular case. Hartwig notes that if an officer is charged under Article 133 that and it's purely to do with private speech, then the clear and present danger standard applies. And that's that heightened standard that Hartwig stood for.
So you agree clear and present danger is the correct standard?
Your Honor had asked about U.S. v. Wilcox, and Wilcox is an Article 134 question, Your Honor. But certainly appellee would say and agree with the Air Force's amicus brief that this Court should impose the new rules set forth by the Supreme Court that has a different approach to private protected speech.
But how is that issue before us? Parties haven't had an opportunity to really address that issue head on. To the extent that we need to consider stare decisis principles, those have not been put in front of us. In your brief and now before us, you seem to be fine with clear and present danger. So why should we open the box on the issue of what the correct standard is in a 133 context with First Amendment issues?
Appellee is fine with the outcome of the Army Court in so much as it made the correct decision to set aside the findings, Your Honor. And the First Amendment issue was heavily litigated at the court below. While it hasn't been litigated here, the issue is still preserved, Your Honor. And because there are certified questions, that does not necessarily limit this court via its Article 67 powers to not address that issue.
But you didn't address it in your brief.
We did not, Your Honor. Understood, Your Honor. However, that is purely because the certified questions in this particular case were about the instructional issue, and Apelli chose to tackle those particular issues, Your Honor. Your Honor, given the instructions did not occur properly in this case, that the military judge failed to instruct the panel properly, the Army Court's decision should not be disturbed. This Court should afford the Army Court an abuse of discretion standard, and because their findings of fact and conclusions of law were correct, this Court, again, should not disturb that ruling. As such,
Counsel, before, it sounds like you're about to wind up, or are you going to go to another argument?
Perfectly open to you, wherever we're
okay.
Going.
Okay. I'm sorry. I wanted to go back because you initially said this case should not have gone to the panel at all. And so if that's the appellant's argument, I mean, are you arguing any alternative that, okay, it should not have gone, it was protected speech, it should not have gone, but since the CCA concluded error, then we're okay with the fact that the CCA concluded error. I think in a way, it's kind of the back end of how the Chief was asking the question of getting to the First Amendment issue.
Yes, Your Honor. And yes, we would agree essentially with your concise statement there. However, as the Chief Judge pointed out, we did not brief that issue.
Okay.
So while Apelli's position is it should not have gone in front of the fact finder, that is not necessarily any of the certified questions in this case. And so Apelli understands what the Army Court's decision was saying and agrees to the ultimate decision that set aside the findings.
Counsel, you've argued that there was no waiver, and if anything, it was a forfeiture, but you believe it was preserved. Judge Johnson asked the government the question, did the government relinquish its waiver argument by not raising it at the Court of Criminal Appeals? And I recall the government's argument was, well, because the Court of Criminal Appeals addressed the issue, it is a proper issue for us to consider on appeal. Do you believe that, and I understand that you don't think that there was waiver just on the merits, but do you believe that the government relinquished its waiver argument?
Yes, Your Honor. They did not argue waiver at the lower court.
And what about their response, though, that since the lower court addressed whether this issue was preserved or not, that is now a proper subject for us to review?
The parties at the lower court litigated the First Amendment issue fairly full, and the Army Court was not well outside of its bounds. In fact, I do believe, I won't go out as far on a limb, but that the Army Court on its own raised the issue. I do believe that was argued as well in parties' briefings, though I can double-check and file a briefing later if the Court so requests. However, in this case, whether or not the Army Court raised it on their own, the government knew that this was an issue from the outset. It was well litigated at trial, and it was a fairly full briefing at the Army Court. As Colonel Wallace did not waive the issue of proper panel instructions and the military judge omitted the required instructions, the Army Court did not abuse its discretion when it set aside the findings in this case. Colonel Ellis requests this Court either affirm the Army Court's decision or dismiss outright based on the constitutional concerns. Pending any questions from the Court.
Thank you, Captain Creighton.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Captain Schaefer.
Your Honor, first, in responding a little more specifically to the direct and palpable connection, in U.S. v. Meekin, it was stated that 133 there is not a requirement for a separate connection to the military mission. Instead, the connection to the military mission is this heightened standard that officers are held to. They have to command the respect and obedience of their subordinates. And so this is the connection. This is the clear and present danger, the gravamen of the offense. And so the military judge, in instructing on the elements and definitions from the model instruction, gave the necessary guideposts. And it is unclear what beyond that would have been necessary under the clear and present danger test, a legal test that was concluded beforehand. Again, whether it's the Wilcox factors or the clear and present danger test, this is a question of law. And this is not something that the members are going to be deciding whether there is constitutional protection. Otherwise protected speech can be unprotected in the military context based on our military society and requirements. There is a heightened standard. That language is there, but in stating that there is an elevated standard under the clear and present danger test, that doesn't answer the question of whether there should have been an additional instruction. The elevated test is simply if this is protected on the civilian side. There's not a requirement under 40 to instruct that this would have been protected on the civilian side. There's not a necessity to have them answer a question of law. Instead, it is simply to go to that terminal element, that conduct unbecoming. And so whatever operative legal guidance was necessary to be given has been given. Now, there was affirmative waiver in this case for specifically the instructional question. But even if affirmative waiver is not found, Article 133 can criminalize otherwise protected private speech. It simply must meet the Hartwig clear and present danger test. The military judge answers this question of law, and then the important part is that he puts the elements and definitions to the fact finder from the model instruction. This court has the opportunity to reaffirm this principle about instructions specifically that up until now has been unquestioned, and to fix the confusion that the Army Court's opinion has caused for military judges and military justice practitioners. Therefore, this court should reverse the Army Court opinion and remand for consideration of any previously mooted issues, pending any questions from the court.
Seeing none, thank you.
Thank you.
Case is now submitted. The court thanks counsel for both sides, and the court will stand adjourned until further order of the court.
All rise. Court is adjourned until further order of the court.